Coming up on this week's episode of Search with Candor, I'm talking to Alex Harford from Salience, all about the things you might be taking for granted about your websites. That includes everything from status codes to page templates, and even a little dip into a few different coding languages as well. All that and more coming up on this week's episode of Search with Candor. Hello and welcome to episode 6 of season 3 of Search with Candor. My name is Jack Chambers Ward. I am still your host, don't worry. And we're getting there. We're moving through season 3. Hopefully you've been joining us on YouTube or Spotify watching the podcast now that you can actually watch it. We are very much appreciating the comments and support you guys have been leaving. So hugely, hugely appreciate that. Thank you so much. In this episode, I'll be talking with a technical SEO consultant and mentor from Salience, the one and only Alex Harford. We nerd out about a lot of stuff, and we're both big nerds, don't get me wrong. We talk a lot about technical SEO and essentially breaking down what we think a lot of SEOs kind of take for granted. And this is kind of discussing Alex's journey from going from web development to working in technical SEO, and a lot of the stuff he kind of assumed a lot of people knew how websites work, but maybe a lot of us SEOs don't actually pay attention to this kind of stuff. We talk everything from different types of status codes and what they mean and how they work, and different types of page templates and why they matter, even down to things like user accessibility and the importance of user experience in SEO and how they're often kind of the same thing. It's a very broad, wide-ranging conversation. It'll be about an hour long or so, as you've probably seen from the runtime of the episode. So stay tuned for that in a couple of minutes. But before that, of course, let's take it away to our fantastic sponsors for this week. The first sponsor for this week's episode is Also Asked. You can go to alsoask.com and check out this fantastic and unique intent research tool. As we probably already know, search intent is at the core of everything we do as SEOs. Even if you're not directly working in content, understanding what your users are trying to achieve through their searches is still pretty important. I think we can all agree. On top of this, Google has told us that it takes up to 9 searches for users to complete their goals. This can be a pretty hard picture to capture, to be honest, with traditional keyword research tools. So what if you could get hold of up-to-the-minute questions that users have asked that have been clustered by intent by Google themselves? Well, that's exactly what Also Asked actually does. Also Asked mines and organizes Google's People Also Asked data in real time, showing you the next most likely question your searchers are going to ask. Best of all, it's completely free. You don't even need to create an account to try out Also Asked. Of course, if you do find it useful, there are paid options as well. We have the free, we have the light, and we have the pro options in terms of accounts that you can subscribe to. At the touch of a button from these accounts, you can download not only the questions people are asking, but also the answers Google has selected, the website URLs, and the titles that are ranking for those answers as well. Also Asked has the world's only API for People Also Asked data, meaning you can combine this data you're pulling from whatever questions you're asking directly into tools. You can combine it with things like ChatGPT to really supercharge your content briefs and transform the way you write content at scale. Go to alsoasked.com and check out this fantastic intent research tool today. Our next sponsor is Core Updates. That is the latest newsletter from the one and only Mark Williams Cook. You may know Mark from his unsolicited SEO tips and his appearances on this very show. He started this podcast, in fact, and is going to be my co-host every single month on our monthly news recap episodes. But if you just want a bit more Mark, you want all of his unsolicited SEO tips, get them actually solicited directly to your inbox every single week. You get the latest episode of this podcast. You get all of the latest SEO news and articles that Mark has selected and thinks are the things you should be paying attention to. All of that delivered to your inbox every single Monday. So if you want to get, like I said, Mark's usual recaps and stuff, it is one of the best places to go for the latest SEO news and pretty much what you can expect from the best in the industry when it comes to the articles and news that is going on, any updates from Google and all that kind of stuff. Go to coreupdates.com and sign up today to get SEO news, brand new episodes of this very podcast, and Mark's SEO tips delivered straight to your inbox. Coreupdates.com is the place to go. My guest this week has been coding websites since he was a teenager and is also currently the technical SEO consultant and mentor at Salience Search Marketing. Welcome to the show, Alex Alford.
Hi, Jack. It's great to be here.
Thank you so much for coming on. I know we have a mutual friend, former guest, Joe O'Reilly, has shouted your name out and was the reason I started following you on LinkedIn and Twitter many, many months ago now. And you are a fantastic follow on both. So it's very nice to have you on the show.
Oh, cool. Thanks, Joe. Joe's brilliant as well. Really enjoyed working with Joe.
Joe's the best. She's the coolest. And it's very cool to kind of like get that recommendation from the rest of the industry, you know, where it's like, oh yeah, you should be talking about this person. Joe's not a technical SEO person, but you are, and Joe's a digital PR person. So it's, I love that kind of balance where you get different people from different parts of the industry kind of working together and recommending each other, and works out well for me because I get awesome podcast guests. So I mentioned Salience, where you're working at the moment, and that is kind of part of the inspiration for the topic for this week's episode. And I love the way you kind of built it and pitched it to me when we were having our initial conversation on Twitter. Was we kind of thought about it as website 101, or more commonly the things SEOs take for granted, right? And I think this is part of a wider conversation where I know I've experienced it. You know, I'm what, 5 years into my SEO officially full-time SEO career now, and I know plenty more for you, Alex. Far more experienced than I am. But that kind of thing where you're having a conversation with somebody who is brand new in the industry, or even maybe not in the industry at all, or just less technical or in the content side of things, whatever it is, and you realize all the stuff you've kind of learned, you kind of take for granted now. This is the kind of thing where we want to think about it. And I know this was part of your internal training at Salience, right, to help onboard new people and introduce people to these concepts, right?
Yeah, that's it. So it was Andy Jobber, actually, one of the directors. He just came up with the idea of this academy for new starters. So probably many of the listeners, myself, after my uni degree, I struggled to get a job related to my degree. It took 3 or 4 years for me to get a web development job. And a lot of the feedback I got was, you haven't got the experience. I'm like, well, how do you get the experience? I need a job to get the experience.
It's the classic. You need five years of experience to get a starter job. I was like, well, how do you get a starter job if you don't have catch 22?
Exactly. Yeah. So I created this technical SEO academy at Salience just for that exact reason. So people who applied, you know, didn't require any experience at all in SEO or technical SEO. We've got Natalie Took at Salience as well. She created the content academy. So the same side of things, SEO-wise, for content people or anyone who's interested in writing. I've learned a lot from just training the sort of new starters. There's just so much I took for granted. Even when I moved from web developer to SEO, just certain things as well. So yeah, sort of looking forward to maybe sharing a few of those things and helping people out to it, not just new to the industry, but I think sometimes experienced SEOs miss things as well, because perhaps I mean, I myself have learned a lot during the academy, so it's been really good for me.
I've heard the phrase that, you know, you learn something when you initially learn it, you learn it again when you start doing it, and you finally actually learn it when you start teaching it. And there's a whole kind of like process of going through, and like you said, you end up learning new things even as you're teaching and even as you're going through. I've definitely found that from, you know, onboarding new people at Canda or working with other people, you know, in previous roles and stuff like that as well. I think there's a huge element to actually writing stuff down and having to present it in a way that you realize, like, oh yeah, I've been taking this for granted. Oh yeah, this is actually a much clearer way of saying it that I've always thought about it as option one in my head, and now option two is actually the much better way of doing it. Or things have changed since you learned it. I know a lot has changed even since I've been in the industry over the last few years. Like I said, I'd imagine since you've been building websites in your teens, there's a lot that's changed across, again, coming from web development through to more technical SEO stuff. I'm sure a lot has changed over the years, right?
I suppose so, but from my perspective, no. So yeah, I mean, the reason I got interested in SEO was because as a web designer and developer, I made what I thought were user-friendly websites. So one of my first tasks when I was a web developer, it was for a publishing company, it was just to redesign and recode a website. So I just made it more user-friendly. I mean, a lot of things that weren't thought of 15 years ago so much, like I made the font larger, just cleaned up the title tags, made the main menu navigation better, just sort of things like that. And I didn't know anything about SEO then. And when the website launched, the traffic literally doubled overnight, the organic traffic. The conversions pretty much doubled as well. They almost doubled. So I've always been a sort of thought of SEO as usability first. So in terms of what I think of SEO, not that much has changed. but Google, especially, you know, with things like Core Web Vitals and so on, that they are moving towards the trying as best as they can with machines, judging the sort of user side of things. So, yeah, I mean, things have definitely changed. I mean, I was never someone who wanted to stuff keywords into content and that kind of thing and black hat link building. So, yeah, things have definitely changed. But from my perspective, I wouldn't say they have so much.
I think that's a really interesting way to put it. It's something Mark says a lot as well, my co-host and director here at Canda, Mark Williams-Cook, says, like, actually, if you've been doing good fundamental SEO, whether that's, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, kind of the fundamentals still kind of apply now. And like you said, you almost find yourself, if you're doing good stuff that is user first, that is user focused, you find that you are already ticking a lot of the boxes from, like, people panicking, helpful content updates and all this kind of stuff, right? A lot of the fundamental stuff is still good. And I love the fact that you were talking there about simple things like making the font size bigger, making sure people can actually read your text and stuff. Like, what a unique, interesting concept. Like, you think that would be so obvious and intuitive. But actually, I know recently a lot of people were criticizing. There was a particular document that was going around the industry from, I think it was from SEMrush, and they were talking about their ranking factors and did like a big study analysis, really brilliant study, really interesting data, but the text on the actual background was very low contrast compared to the background. It was like light gray on a dark gray background, which is hard for a lot of people to read. And it's tiny little things like that that aren't really SEO, but at the end of the day, you want users to read your content, to understand your website, as much as, you know, we create things for the robots and the crawlers and stuff as well. Yet at the end of the day, it's a user-focused industry, right? We want people to, they are the people that are coming onto the website and buying the things or clicking the things or whatever it is.
Yeah, I completely agree. Another recent example, I don't know if it was yesterday or the day before, Danny Sullivan, the Google search liaison, tweeted about, well, Google don't read bylines, you know, you don't add them for Google. And I saw the headline and I thought, well, people might just start removing bylines or not bothering with them on the website now. But, you know, you click through to read more on search engine land, I think it was, or on Danny's tweets. And he says they're there for the user. It's the trust for the user. So the person reading the content, if they know it's written by someone, you know, it's not just AI generated, I suppose, is becoming a big issue, isn't it? I think most of what we do is to make websites user-friendly and trustworthy. I don't think of SEO for Google, really, on the whole, especially when I'm sort of talking to new SEOs. I mean, obviously, there are exceptions. There are certain technical SEO things that are important. But on the whole, I always think, if we're making an SEO recommendation, just think usability first. And if it's going to have any chance of making the usability of the website worse, then just don't do it.
Yeah, totally agreed. I know there's been a big push in the industry. People like Sarah Camano Fernandez talking about like the SXO, kind of that search experience optimization, where combining kind of a lot of UX best practices and SEO, kind of combining them together. And I think, like you said, a lot of people are kind of been doing that for a while, and that's where a lot of the industry is now kind of catching up with a lot of the other people. Like, if you're already doing user first stuff, then hopefully UX is already a part of your practices and already a part of your guidelines, whether you're training internally, whether you're working on client websites, whatever it is. Like, you coming in from that initial step. And I think it's a brilliant example you were saying there of, like, when you're introducing brand new people to SEO, if you can already set them off on that right foot rather than picking up the baggage and learning all of the less useful stuff from, you know, like you said, black hats and all that kind of stuff that was PBNs and all the kind of stuff that happened over the years that we're now seeing less and less of. If you can get off on the right foot straight away and people learn it from a user-focused perspective, I think that can be a real game-changer compared to the hyper-focus some people have on, like, oh, it has to be Google-friendly, it has to be this thing, it has to be, you know, super focused on the machine side of things rather than the human side of things.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, another thing, probably over the last year or two, that internal links have suddenly become a massive important thing, but they always have been, haven't they? So I think it's great because I think a raising tide rises all ships, doesn't it? So if websites are getting better in general, if SEO advice like that is coming out from, you know, these sort of influencers with, you know, tens of thousands of followers and so on, then yeah, it's great. It makes websites better for everyone. It's just a bit strange sometimes how things go. I've sort of lost my train of thought there.
I think that was a lot of what the two Verge articles, I don't know if you've read the latest one that was 15,000 bloody words or whatever it was, like the unbelievably long Verge articles, the original Alligator Party content goblin one, and then the one talking about specific on-page optimization stuff. And I know... the general like idea of it I agree with is that a lot of bad practices are leading to a worse experience on SERP sometimes. But if you're doing SEO right and you're doing it with a user focus, and they did a weird thing where they were calling out like, oh, using a clickable contents table to drive more traffic. Like, that's not to drive more traffic, that's accessibility. That's a basic navigational thing. Like, what are you talking about? And calling out these weird... Exactly, Oh, they're using headers to break up the text, those scoundrels. I'm like, yeah, I find it much easier to read a wall of text if it's broken up into individual bits that I can then process myself and be like, actually, I don't care about the first header, let's skip to the second header. I can actually, again, navigate its accessibility, its usability. It blows my mind that they were so just like, oh, headers and content tables are the worst, they're ruining the internet. Like, I don't think they are. I think they're a thing everybody uses every day.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I think like a lot of things in life, I think it's about balance. So a lot of websites, they, you know, they'll just answer the, you know, find what they've got, and people also ask on the Google search results, and they'll just put a list of those on the web page. And so I think a lot of websites have become very formulaic and sort of boring to read. So I think I get where that Verge article was coming from. But it just kind of, so I thought, was tarring all SEOs with the same brush, I sort of thought. And there are perhaps some examples in there that they were saying, well, this is good SEO that Google wants, where I thought, well, it's not really good SEO. I think sort of good, experienced SEOs wouldn't do the sort of kind of things that they were suggesting in that article. So I was sort of a bit disappointed in the article. Thought it could have, and I think there was something about... long tail keywords, and they got the definition wrong. So, you know, could have been better researched, but yeah, it started off well, but I ended up being a bit disappointed with it overall. I haven't read all the way to the end yet.
I don't think anyone has, mate. I don't think anyone has. but yeah, let's get on to our topic. I know we've kind of touched on some of the fundamentals there, some of the ideas and the basic kind of constructions, but let's get into, I think, some of the more technical stuff, right? We're going to think about what the changes we can make as SEOs, the options we have when it comes to looking at our websites and understanding how they work. And I guess let's start off with where many people first experience a website is the URL itself. And I think this is something, there are a lot of different names for things. There's a lot of misconstrued things. There's a lot of different ways people will use similar phrases meaning different things and stuff like that. So should we start off with thinking about the URL structure itself and actually how you kind of describe it to other people who were learning SEO?
So actually when I was a web developer, actually, is when I got started with URLs. I think it's one of the first things I sort of did as a web developer was to implement friendly URLs on this publisher website. So friendly URLs, I think just shortly and concise, descriptively but concisely describe what you can expect to find on the content of a web page. So an example I often use is just if you're on a beds website, you're looking for double beds, the sort of ideal URL. So this is after the domain. So say example.com/, and then you get the subfolders, something like /beds/double. It just brilliantly describes what's on that page. As SEOs, we can make recommendations on that part of the URL. I think we do have to be careful, because changing URLs, means search bots and people won't be able to find that URL if they've bookmarked it or if they come to it from a search engine. So, you know, we have to be aware of redirects, which we'll perhaps talk about in a bit. So I've lost my train of thought again.
No, I think that's totally relevant where, like, you think about the changing of the URL, I think is something a lot of people discuss, where, like, if you can avoid changing the URL, you probably should. But I've also found it, funnily enough, I was working, not with a client, but with a friend's website, and I can't remember what CMS they were using, but it automatically put the year and, like, slash live or something after the end of every URL. So it'd be like, domain, category, page, 2023, live. And I was like, get rid of that live 2023 bit, because that will be outdated. And this was in, like, November. Like, that'll be outdated in 6 weeks. By the time it comes around to 2024, are you going to change that to 2024? Or are you just stating that, like, you know, in 2 years' time, this is massively out of date and all that kind of stuff? I think you're totally right there. We should have simple and descriptive is the concise and descriptive is the perfect way of putting it, right? Like, perfect example of that, beds, double beds kind of thing. You could easily have beds slash double beds slash double, and you get those, like, layers and layers of, yeah, you've kind of already said it's double beds, you don't need to say double beds and, like, all this kind of stuff. I found that a lot with a lot when you get big e-commerce websites that a lot of different people have worked on over the years, you'll get duplicate categories that then have various different describing the same thing in various different ways and things like that. And keeping it, like you said, as simple as possible, but still in the same way we think about it for anchor text, right? It clearly describes what you're going to find on that page from a user perspective. If I click on bed slash double, I can probably pretty reasonably guess I'm going to land on a page about double beds. You would hope that would be fairly explanatory, but it's not over convoluted. You're not repeating the information. You're not kind of, like, double tracking yourself. So I think, yeah, that is a good thing. I think a lot of people kind of take for granted, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's good to mention the keyword stuffing as well. So in the olden days of SEO, people would just, you know, they would just stuff it. They'd say beds.com slash beds slash double beds slash beds double and that kind of thing. And if you think about it from a usability perspective, it's, you know, it's not easy for someone to read, is it, when they just see the link?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a, thankfully, a shift away from that over the last few years, I would hope. Yeah. Outside of everywhere apart from Amazon, which I still find Amazon keyword, that's a whole other industry, don't get me wrong. But, like, the Amazon product descriptions and product titles drive me absolutely mad. I remember having this conversation with my wife every time. She'd be like, oh, should we buy this thing on Amazon? And me being the SEO, I read the product title word for word, syllable for syllable. It's like, yes, we need a mattress for bed, double bed, extra large bed, duvet cover, cover for duvets, duvets for large bed, duvet. I'm like, oh God, this feels like I'm back in 1998. Like, what is this?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that sort of touches on something else I was going to mention. So have clients who will mention it, the name of a big brand, and they'll want to copy the SEO of that sort of company because they rank, you know, towards the top of Google. They're not at the top of Google because of the brilliant SEO. So we had a client who wanted to copy the main navigation of a really sort of big high street brand in the UK. And I won't mention the name, but if you actually go on the website and try and find a product, it's so difficult. You sort of end up going back to Google and specifically searching for it or using the on-site search. So I think it's another good thing to make new SEOs aware of, is just because something ranks well in search engines, it doesn't necessarily mean that SEO is brilliant on the website. And there might be all kinds of reasons for that. You know, I wouldn't be critical of any sort of individual companies or SEOs who work at these companies, because I've worked with companies where it's difficult to get changes implemented, and SEO isn't the only consideration.
Yeah, I think that's such a huge part of that process and having that conversation with clients. Like you said, that if there's a household name that is in a similar industry, they'd be like, oh, why don't we just copy, I'm going to use Amazon example because it's a generic cover all kind of thing, like, why don't we just use the same nav as Amazon? I'm like, yeah, good luck with that. Do you have an internal developer team that is, like, hundreds and hundreds, possibly thousands of people? Like, be my guest if you want to copy Amazon's infrastructure. Are you one of the biggest companies in the history of the world? I don't think you are. Has your CEO been to space with a cowboy hat on for some reason?
God.
I don't think he has. Yeah. Like, I think that's a huge thing where, like you said, when you want to kind of understand where, for want of a better phrase, the SEO benefits are coming from, but there is a huge amount of stuff bubbling on the surface, which is kind of what we're going to get into in a second, of it's not just about the keywords, it's not just about what's in the URL, let alone what's on the page. There's so many other factors in there that, you know, some massive companies have had integrated into their systems for decades at this point. Some people are coming to it brand new. There are so many other things kind of going, bubbling around under the surface, like I said, where I think you can't even get that, just even with the typical SEO tools, or even if you're looking at the backlink profile and looking at all this kind of stuff, yet you're not going to compete with massive household names on a grand scale. Don't get me wrong, you can beat them. I have outranked Amazon a couple of times for certain clients for certain phrases and all that kind of stuff. It's I'm not saying it's not entirely possible, but I think you're right that there is that kind of easy to misunderstand stuff of like, oh, if we copy this nav, it will benefit us. Whereas you actually, again, coming back around to what we're talking about at the beginning of the episode, think about users first. Is your user base the same as that particular, you know, competitor or a household name, whatever it is? Does it make sense that, take again, I'm using Amazon because they're an easy target and nobody at Amazon's going to get offended because they're too big to care. No, I doubt anybody from Amazon listens to the podcast. I'm sure we're fine.
Your email inbox will be flooded soon.
Yeah, exactly.
Disgruntled Amazon employees.
Well, there's plenty of them, but they won't be worried about my podcast.
No.
they got bigger things to worry about as an Amazon employee. Anyway, let's move on from Amazon, shall we? And think about outside of the URLs and talk about servers and web servers. Because again, I think this is something we hear that phrase a lot. You hear, you know, different status codes and server-side rendering and blah, 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 and all these kind of like server-based terms. And I know it's definitely something I'm not the most technical SEO. I'll totally hold my hands up right now and say that. Like, I come from a content background for sure. So hearing a lot of the different things, I think some of them we take for granted. Everybody kind of knows a lot of the status codes and stuff, but there is a lot of nuance in there and a lot of extra bits that I think we're going to unpick now and kind of discuss. So from your perspective, Alex, like, what do you think are some of the more useful things to know about what we should know as SEOs about web servers and how they work and you know, the kind of status codes we should expect?
Well, in my head, it's simpler, I think, than many people realize. So a web server is basically just another computer that's got a copy of a website on, isn't it? And it's connected through the internet. So I think that, I hope, helps demystify it for a lot of people. So you get CDNs, so content delivery networks. So, you know, if say Moz.com, for example, it's got a worldwide audience. In the early days of the internet, when it was SEO Moz, probably they might not have had a CDN. So if someone in the UK or Australia visited SEOMoz.com, the website would have had to travel through cables all across the world, from Seattle, where Moz are based, to the UK or Australia or wherever. But now content delivery networks exist. So if we visit Moz in the UK or someone visits it in Japan or wherever, there will probably be a server, a web server nearby that's got a copy of that website, so it can be delivered to you quickly. So I don't think, as technical SEOs or even SEOs, just SEOs, we don't need to know huge amounts about web servers. I think maybe knowing it as on just another computer pretty much hopefully helps demystify it. In terms of status codes, I mean, they are probably something I took for granted coming from being a web developer. So we've got some new people in the academy at Salience learning them at the moment, so we've stuck post-it notes up around to get them stuck in people's heads. So there's 200 okay server response, isn't there, which generally means everything's okay. The web server responded, sent you the web page you requested back when you typed in the URL. I imagine quite a lot of your audience have got browser extensions that can show server status code. So I use, which one is it? I'll just double check, because I always get the name slightly wrong because we've got another tool. so I use link redirect trace to show me the server code that comes back from a website. A lot of people use the IIMA one as well. So yeah, I think it's important to know that sometimes there can be an error with a web page and it can still come back 200 okay. So that's one of the things we look at when we're auditing and figure out why that is. And they're known as soft 404s. I think 404 not found is probably the server response that most people are familiar with, because it'll come up. And that's probably a good example of web developers just taking things for granted. So if you're not a web developer and you go onto an error page on a website and it says 404 not found, what exactly does that mean to just a normal person who's not technically minded, doesn't know about the internet? It's one of those things that just happens, doesn't it? But people are familiar with it as a result.
Those three are kind of the ones a lot of people think about when it comes to 200 and 404 are the most common when it comes to your average kind of users, right? You're going to find a lot of okay means everything's working fine, that's totally normal. 99% of the time that is the status code you're experiencing. Plenty of people experience 404s. I love when sites have a custom 404 page that is actually helpful and helps you navigate either back to the thing you were coming from, or here's our FAQs or whatever it is, like a navigation tool that will allow you to find your way back to a home page or a category page or whatever it is. I think there's some opportunity there on 404 pages that a lot of people kind of take for granted as, oh, it's a broken thing, don't worry about it. Actually, no, you want your users to not just get stuck there and leave. There is actually opportunity for them to then continue their journey and kind of navigate from there, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's a brilliant example of usability in SEO aligning. And again, I mean, it's not directly SEO, is it? But if someone lands on a not found page and there's the main menu navigation isn't there, then it's not very helpful, is it? They have to press back, whether that's to a search engine or somewhere else on the website. But if the main navigation is there, they can already navigate around the rest of the website. You can put options on the error page. Where you're looking for this? Maybe most popular products or categories. I mean, even web developers, some web developers, it depends on, I don't want to web developers to suddenly get a load of requests because of something I've said, but it'll depend on the framework a website uses and so on. But they might be able to implement something where the 404 page can be sort of automated based on what's in the URL. So, going back to the double beds example, if there's a broken URL and it's got double beds in there somewhere, the 404 page might show where you're looking for double beds, like the person browsing the website, oh yeah, it was, and then they can just click it. So yeah, there are definitely ways. I think it's sort of good 404 pages that are user-friendly is definitely an underused thing.
Yeah, definitely. When you come around to the 300s, there's a few different, I think 301 and 302 are kind of the most common ones. Most people probably know what a 301 is in terms of that actually getting a redirect and permanently redirecting something. 302 and the other two, I think, are not that many people are using day-to-day or encounter day-to-day. 304 and 307. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit for us, Alex, the differences there?
Yeah, so 304 that sort of means not modified. So it's actually quite useful for really big websites, so where crawl budget is a consideration. So if there's a website where perhaps new pages or content changes are not getting indexed very quickly by Google or any other search engine, then you can set the sort of status to return 304 not modified. So that'll tell Googlebot or whatever search bot that's visiting the website when they come to it, oh, this hasn't been modified, this page, since this date, so there's no point of crawling it. So you're saving Google and Bing resources there. And then when the page does change, you can just remove that 304 not modified. And when Googlebot or Bingbot comes back, they'll know, oh, it doesn't say not modified anymore. We'll crawl this page and index the changes. So I think that's quite an underused one. When crawl budget is a consideration for websites. Yeah, so the other one, I think there's a bit of confusion over 307. It's probably the fault of the people who implement these various technical things online. But a 307 redirect can be sent by a server or a web browser. So when it's sent by a server, it's similar to 302 found, so just kind of a temporary redirect. And when it's sent by a browser, so Chrome or Firefox or whatever, it means someone has put into the browser or clicked to an HTTP URL. But something on that website with the HTTP URL has previously said this website should only be accessed at HTTPS, so secure URLs. So when a 307 comes from a browser, it will just automatically redirect that website to HTTPS, whatever the URL is. I mean, it's kind of a bit of a bugbear with me, and this kind of would get very sort of technical. Maybe I could provide a link for the show notes, but a lot of websites implement something called HSTS, which stands for HTTP Strict Transport Security. And I think it causes more problems than it fixes, because if websites don't implement it properly, it sort of causes issues. And I think, and I'm not 100% on it, but I think if you implement it for one part of a domain, so say you've got www.subdomain and you implement HSTS, then it'll apply, or it's supposed to apply, for every single other subdomain that you might have. So, you know, you might have www.example.com, you might have support.example.com. And so, yeah, HSTS can cause issues. So it's kind of one of those. I mean, and some other advice I give sort of when I'm sort of training US SEOs is I'll say, don't give recommendations that you don't understand. So, you know, always encourage people to look up things if they don't understand them. So sort of try and allow that time within the work, or have someone available to ask who might know. So yeah, that HSTS, I won't go into detail on it, but it's a bit of a bugbear of mine. Grinds my gears. That's the modern way to say it, isn't it?
We'll definitely put that link in the show notes. If you do want to explore it more, listeners and viewers, you can go and check out more about HSTS in the show notes. I think, again, we mentioned 404. There's also 401, 403, and even 410 as well. We won't spend too much. We're not just going to do an entire podcast breaking down status codes. Don't worry, listeners. But yeah. I think 410 is the one I kind of want to focus on there. That's the one I think a lot of people misunderstand, misuse. That's something I've encountered a lot in e-commerce, where you want to kind of actually tell somebody, whether that's the user or Google or whatever it is, where it's actually properly gone. It is no longer available and has been removed permanently, rather than a 404 not found is kind of more of an error kind of thing. This is a purposeful choice that you have removed a particular page.
Yeah, so we've already talked about 404, haven't we, and how it's probably the most commonly known error code. So I think a lot of web developers use it by default, you know, obvious reasons. But if something is 404 not found, as far as a search engine is concerned, when it's crawling a website, it could be anything. Well, is it temporarily not found? Has it changed to a different URL? But with a 410 gone, you're basically saying to the search bot, well, yeah, this is permanently gone, so you don't need to come back to this URL again. Whereas if you use the 404 not found again, Googlebot, I've seen it in server log files and Bingbot also, they will just keep recrawling this 404 not found just in case it's a temporary error and the URL is going to come back. Whereas if you remove something like, say, an e-commerce website has a big purge of products, for example, if they put 404 not found as the URL status, then you've got all these hundreds of URLs that search bots are potentially going to be crawling again and again, and you're sort of wasting their time and resources. Whereas if you put 410 gone, search bot will see it's 410 gone. They still do come back again, just to double check, maybe triple check. I've seen in log files, they still come back again, 410 gone, just to make sure it is. But it saves a lot of search engine resources when you use 410 gone, when that URL has permanently gone and it's not been replaced elsewhere, so you don't need to redirect it. And so I think the big part of technical SEO, if not the main part for me, is just making life as easy as possible for search engines to sort of discover, crawl, render, and index your website and web pages. So 410, For websites with sort of fewer pages, it probably doesn't make a big difference, but big e-commerce sites, it definitely has its benefits.
Yeah, definitely.
So the search bots can just crawl the other parts of your website that you want indexed instead of wasting their resources on stuff that isn't useful to them or anyone.
Yeah, definitely. I think that is, like I said, commonly mixed up between 404 and 410 from my experience. And actually recommending some clients on e-commerce sites actually use 410 when they have permanently removed a product range or whatever it is can actually be useful, like you said, in saving that crawler resources when it comes to actually looking at crawl budget and stuff like that, especially when it comes to really, really big e-commerce sites with tens of thousands of products and stuff like that. Next, we kind of have a pairing of, and we'll kind of finish off the status code side of things, with the 500, which I think, probably most people have encountered, but also the 503 as well.
Yeah, so the 500 server error, that's just a generic error code when the server doesn't know what the error is or there's not another suitable error code that it can show. So it's kind of a default. I think 503 service unavailable to give it the full name. Again, I think it's probably quite an underused server status code. So it means the server can't respond to the request, but it also means it's generally a temporary state. So if a client has got the website under maintenance, for example, they're making some updates and the website's going to be down for an hour or two, then what you want to do is use 503 service unavailable status code, because that's telling any search bot that visits the website is temporarily unavailable, but we will be back. So please check again soon. So again, it's kind of saving search engine resources in a way, if you just look at it in terms of pleasing the search engines. So, I mean, it's salience. The reason I think it's undervalued is that salience, when we have new clients come on and they have development websites, when the website goes down for maintenance, it'll often say 404 not found or 500 server error. So the search bots are just encountering that and just thinking, oh, this website was working fine 10 minutes ago or when I last called, what's happened? And so the search bot just doesn't know what's happening. Whereas if you use 503, the search bot knows your intention.
Yeah, definitely. You touched on CDNs a little bit earlier as well. How much do we need to know about CDNs and basically when are they necessary? When do we need to think about that when it comes to SEO and making our site usable?
I do think CDNs are overrated. I think I'm probably going to get a load of hate mail maybe from you'll get it from Amazon, I'll get it from all the CDNs.
All the angry Cloudflare employees emailing you right now.
Yeah. I wasn't going to mention any names, but you have. So, I think they're a bit. There's a study. I really wish I could find it, but I can't find it. That someone did. It's not the only one I've seen, but they actually tested a website with a CDN and without a CDN, and just tested it across different parts of the world, and the CDN didn't have any speed benefits. So I think it sort of depends on the audience of the website. So if you're a UK-based company and your audience or customers are primarily, say, 99% or something, it's an arbitrary number in the UK, then do you really need a CDN to speed up your website? Perhaps not. I mean, there are other benefits that CDNs have, but it's kind of weighing up that they are pretty expensive, a lot of them, so it's kind of weighing up the sort of benefit vis the cost. But I think if a website is generally fast, in a lot of cases, I don't think a CDN is necessary. So I don't know, perhaps could save a few businesses some money on CDNs there. But it's something, it's one of them, it depends things. You know, I wouldn't say hard and fast, yes, use a CDN or don't use a CDN. Every case is unique, isn't it? But in general, I think a lot of websites use CDNs when they don't really need them.
Yeah, I think a lot of them come built into the CMS, right? Like WordPress tends to come with a built-in CDN and stuff like that. Whether you like it or not, they're going to deliver your content through a CDN. So, yeah, I think it's an interesting case. Like, I've had conversations with clients. I mentioned Cloudflare there for a reason, because I've had that conversation. Oh, people keep recommending Cloudflare to us. Should we switch to it? Should we add that to our site? Like, specifically hearing, you know, almost like the more salesy, pitchy kind of stuff of like, it has all these benefits and all this kind of stuff. And nobody, like you said, nobody actually gets the data and does the study. They just kind of get caught up in the discussion of it all. And you'll get a client, again, who maybe doesn't know what a CDN is, doesn't know what currently the one they're using, but has heard this term or heard a particular brand and gone, oh, yeah, we should hop on this thing. Would you recommend we use this particular one or for this particular instance or whatever? And like you said, it's a case-by-case basis, right? It's a conversation you should be having with your clients in terms of, is this right for you? Does this make sense? Have we got any idea of how will it affect things like loading speed and site speed and the interactability of loading those images or whatever content you're hosting on your site? Is that going to change how users actually experience the site in any negative way? Rather than just, yes, every site should have this thing because it's a benefit. I think you're totally right. There's a bit more nuance to it. And yeah, I wouldn't want to be blankly recommending it across the board pretty much.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So, I mean, hopefully that's a conversation starter for people to have, like you say. I mean, one of the advantages that they do have is if a website goes down, so it's unavailable, then some CDNs can show a sort of recent version of the website that was available. So there are other advantages.
So thinking about the URLs, we're thinking about web servers, we're kind of going through this process. The actual pages we're looking at, and I think this is something, when you first came to me with the idea, I think this is something a lot of us kind of underestimate when it comes to SEO. And it's something I talked about with Mark when we do a lot of like technical audits here at Canda and things like that, is page templates and how many you need for your site and how common they are across different websites as well. Because I think a lot of people think of, oh, every page is unique. Every page is a beautiful little snowflake of a internet moment where it's all unique. Like, well, kind of, not really. You've got your various kind of like different most common templates, right? And I think what Mark often says when you're doing a technical audit, if you're working on a huge site, say for example, again, we're using big e-commerce because that's a lot of my experience from a lot of technical auditing and stuff, is if you can at least get an idea, a decent sample of each template and each page template from a technical perspective, that's a pretty good judge of character for the site as a whole. You don't need to necessarily crawl all 17 million URLs or whatever it is, but if you get a decent sample size of each kind of page template, you can get a pretty good picture of, because chances are, if there's an error in a page template, that's going to kind of cascade across the rest of the site, right? So I guess thinking about page templates, do we want to say, like, understanding page templates, do you think that's important as part of understanding technical SEO and how websites work? And how does that factor into your kind of, like, recommendations for auditing processes and stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what you said. It definitely helps. So it's probably the sort of biggest thing I took for granted coming from web development into the SEO world. So I think in the original days of the internet, every page was created individually. So if you imagine you wanted to change the design or layout of a website, you'd have to change every individual page, you know, which would be very, very time consuming. But now, again, e-commerce websites are a good example. It's based on page templates, aren't they? So you've got the home page is generally standalone. Then you might have a category or landing page. If we go back to the using beds as an example, someone might have searched for beds in a search engine. They land on a beds page. And that'll kind of guide customers, hopefully, or sort of consumers to becoming customers of that particular website to the sort of kind of bed they're looking for. So it might list ottoman beds, different sizes of beds, so double and single and so on. And if you think of the template side of things and you're on a sort of furniture website, they'll have a mattresses page. So it'll do a similar thing to what the beds page does. But for mattresses, they might have a sofas page. And all those pages are just based on the same template. So they'll have the same layout. Then other templates, you'll get product listing pages or subcategories, which are just a list of products. And if you look at these pages on a website, they'll all just look layout-wise, generally, pretty much identical. Mm. They'll just have different content or different products on them. And so from a web developer's perspective, that's much easier, much quicker for them, much more efficient for them to make a website, because they can just do this template. And then the people who are responsible for the content can just fill in well, it comes from a database, doesn't it? So all the content on the website is in a database. So whatever CMS, content management system, whoever inputs the content are using, that puts the content into the database, and then the page template requests the relevant content. So from a tech SEO perspective, when you're auditing websites, if you know that a website has just got a sort of limited number of templates, like you said, Jack, just maybe check 3 or 4 of each page, and then you've got a good idea of if there are sort of any issues. Like, even if you're looking at pages from a usability perspective and you're not thinking tech SEO wise, you can just look at 2 or 3 and think, well, these are all the same. And then it's a good assumption to make that the rest of the website, the pages based on this template, are also going to be the same. So if there's an issue on one of them, it's going to be across all of them. There are exceptions sometimes, like we've got one client at Salience, and they do go a bit rogue on some of their template pages sometimes and start adding, they've got videos on some of their sort of PLPs, for example, whereas other pages haven't. So video will make the page slower, especially if it's not lazy loaded. Be aware that templates can change, but it does make auditing websites a lot easier, I think, when we know that they're based on templates.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I think, like I said, that was a big learning moment for me, I'll say 3, 4, 5 years ago, whatever it was, when I kind of got the idea of, when I was first building websites, you know, a bit longer than that, because I was kind of building websites not knowing what I was doing before I got into SEO, if that makes sense, and then realized, oh, I've been doing SEO longer than I thought I had, and realizing, like, oh, I changed this one thing, and that affects all of the category pages across the entire site. I'm like, oh, okay, that's interesting. And you like you said, you realize that as soon as you kind of come to that point of, I can change this one thing, or look at this one thing, or review this one thing from a usability perspective, from a technical perspective, you can then realize how much of the rest of the site that's affecting. When you can then fix those problems, you'll then realize, like, oh, I fixed, you know, half of the entire website is this one template, because it's mostly product pages or whatever it is, right? In terms of sheer numbers of URLs, you can make a huge difference with just little template tweaks here and there. And I've found that to be a big thing when I'm kind of educating clients as well and having that conversation with them, building new templates or understanding what kind of templates they're using, or swapping from CMSs and going through the migration process of, like, here's how this template works compared to this template, I think is something so many of us misunderstand or underestimate, I think, more specifically. And something I now always consciously keep in the back of my head. And I know, I'm sure you have the same thing, Alex. I'm sure viewers and listeners, you have a similar thing where your SEO brain is always on when you're looking at a new website, right? Even if you're just browsing in the evenings, you're not at work, whatever it is, you still have that little SEO brain in the back of your mind going, like, I wonder what template, I wonder what CMS this is. Oh, this looks like Shopify. Oh, this looks like WordPress. Like, having that little thing, I recognize that page template, that kind of moment.
Yeah, we never switch off, do we? I mean, it's a good little tangent there, what you say about the number of URLs you can affect by one change. So a lot of new SEOs struggle with prioritizing recommendations that we give to clients. I feel like it's maybe a bit of an unfair advantage that I used to be a web developer, because find it a lot easier to prioritize things. I mean, obviously still don't get it perfect, and discussion with the client and web developers always helps. But if you're making a change on a website and it changes one of them template pages, like we're saying, if it's a product listing page, for example, say, I don't know, the images are not lazy loaded or not compressed on the particular page, then that's the same across on an e-commerce website that's big, potentially hundreds or thousands of pages. Well, that's likely a high priority recommendation for the client, because it affects and improves so many pages.
Yeah, definitely. I think when you can make those small changes that end up having a big effect, that is definitely something, you know, again, talk about Mark and his process for tech audits and how much I've learned from him since working here at Canda, that kind of prioritization of resources versus actual impact is such a big factor of that. If you need to get an entire internal or external development team to do this one thing that will only affect a little bit of it, maybe that's not the highest priority. But if you can change a couple of things in one of the page templates that then pulls through and fixes. I'm using, again, using e-commerce as an example, all those product pages are suddenly fixed in a certain way, and it's only a couple of bits in a CMS. That can be a thing you can, I hate to use the term quick win, but an easy fix, a quick little thing you can do where you can then put that at the top of priority of like, this is very low resources, only requires a couple of changes that will actually have a huge impact on the site as a whole. And that, for me, coming around to prioritizing that balance between resource required and impact on the site, is where the sweet spots happen, right? That's where it all comes down to.
I like the term quick win. I don't know what he's got against that. I use it in my audience. I actually say it at the start. If there are any quick wins, these are quick wins.
I know a lot of people don't like it. A lot of people see it as like a, almost like a marketing tool of like, I think because it's used and like overpromised by a lot of kind of more dodgy SEO companies.
Okay,
like,
here
are your quick wins. We've audited your website because they just white labeled a Moz or SEMrush export. Here's all your quick wins. Get rid of your toxic backlinks. You're like, brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, I should say, I don't say these are definitely quick wins. I always say these may be quick wins.
That's the difference. So we're talking about page templates, and something I actually touched on when I had Jess Joyce on at the end of the previous season, towards the end of 2023, was talking about coding languages. And I know this is something I have very much like a little bit dipped my toes into, but definitely not my area of expertise. But thinking about the kind of languages we see most commonly used on the internet now in 2024, and thinking about what do you think are the most useful languages for us as SEOs to learn, understand, all that kind of stuff?
I don't think we need to learn to code. I think that was a conclusion you had with Jess, wasn't it? So I think I largely agree with Jess. I don't know if it's a bit of a tangent going off onto Python, but as a sort of an example, a few years ago, I started feeling really under pressure because everyone was talking about Python and saying, oh, all technical SEOs need to know about Python. And the reason I'm not a web developer anymore is because I didn't like coding. So I sort of felt a lot of pressure to learn Python. So it's used for data analysis generally, isn't it, in terms of SEO and sort of getting data. Then I thought, well, it's not something I'm interested in. I don't want to learn any more coding languages. I work at an agency, so if I need someone, some data, you know, that there are people who can approach and ask, their sort of friends and other people I know in the industry, I can ask about things. I mean, especially last year or so, GPT you can use for code and that kind of things if you want to break down data and things like that.
And create Python scripts as well.
Python scripts, yeah. But it's perhaps some good general advice, I think, for any SEO as well. In personally, I became a lot less stressed when I realized that I didn't need to know everything. I just accepted the fact that I would never learn Python because I don't want to, because I sort of felt that my resources are better put elsewhere, maybe growing my knowledge in other areas. So going off on a bit of a tangent to the question you asked, but just because it came into my mind right now, I think part of being a good SEO is sort of knowing where to look as well and who to ask. So we shouldn't, as an SEO, we're not expected to know everything. I think even clients appreciate that. So sometimes I've been in client calls and meetings and, you know, I'll just say if I don't know something, and a lot of the time you can see they sort of visibly seem to appreciate that I'll get back to him later with a sort of proper researched answer. So it's impossible to know everything, isn't it, as an SEO? But getting back onto your question, so I do feel like understanding HTML and CSS is important. So although I said I don't think we need to code, I think they are important for us to understand as tech SEOs. HTML especially, because a lot of the sort of SEO recommendations we make will be sort of related to tags in HTML, like your canonical tag and hreflang if it's an international site, your meta tags like title and description. I mean, a lot of SEOs, these will be the first things that they become familiar with when they start learning about SEO. So I think it kind of shows how straightforward HTML can be. Definitely getting looking at the code and seeing what you can pick out. In terms of whether we should code, I do feel like being a former web developer, it helps me understand more from their perspective. So I think it helps with client relations at times. I have had a couple of times web developers who were just dismissive of me. You know, as an SEO, oh, your recommendations are rubbish. You don't know what you're on about. You know, which you can kind of understand because maybe they've worked with bad SEOs and so on. But then as soon as they realized I used to be a web developer, they suddenly respected me. You know, it's not really a...
Is it about the secret handshake, right?
Yeah. So it's not really a great attitude, is it? You know, I think you should treat everyone with respect and the same. But I think it has helped my career that I used to be a web developer, and it does help client and development relations sometimes. So, you know, even if it's just doing a little course, there are loads of free courses online. Maybe I could share a couple for the show notes. I mean, I'm all completely self-taught, web developer-wise as well. Pretty much, I had a good boss at my publishing company boss, who was a publishing company job, who was a developer. Familiarity, I think, is good. I mean, one thing we can do to help web developers if we don't know how to code is we can sort of provide the logic for them to do things, and then they can put that into code or whatever. So maybe just a sort of really simple example is canonical URLs for, say, pagination. So say you've got sort of product listings and they go over to multiple pages. You don't want the first page of the product listing to ever show page equals one or p equals one in the URL. So you can sort of present that logic to a developer saying, if it's page equals one, don't add that to the URL. If page equals two or greater, then add that to the canonical URL tag, if that makes sense. So that's sort of a really simple example. But we can provide logic to developers, and I think a lot of them do appreciate that, because it just makes them easy to just go away and do the code for it.
Yeah, definitely. I think something you briefly mentioned there, I think, is such a key part, and one of the big takeaways I think we want to have from this episode is the you don't need to know everything, right? And it's something I think we all need to come to terms with when you're on that client call and you're having a difficult conversation. They ask you a question and then you realize, I don't actually know the answer to that question. How do I... Please don't just make something up to save face and just say like, yeah, do a 307, you'll be fine, don't worry about it. And I actually realize like that's not the right answer. And you go away and look it up afterwards and realize. I think there is a lot of power in accountability and a lot of like, it takes a lot more to say, I'm not sure, I'll go and check, or I don't know, I'll check it with my colleagues or my peers or whatever it is, than to just give an answer off the top of your head and hope for the best and wing it, basically. And I think that there is a lot of power in saying, I don't know everything and I don't need to know everything. Like I said, I'm not the most technical SEO. I can handle a bit of HTML and CSS here and there, but you chuck some JavaScript at me and I am dead in the water. I have no idea what I'm doing. Same with PHP, same with, I did a bit of C++ back in my degree. I have a physics degree. For some reason we did programming in it as well. But I hated every second of it. And then I have friends who are just like full-time, you know, programmers and full-time developers and stuff like that. And they have no idea what I'm talking about when it comes to SEO side of things. And I think understanding where your knowledge limit is currently and being open to expanding that and being honest about it, I think is such a key part of life, not to make it sound so dramatic, but I think it's a key part of career progression, right? And it's a big part of life in general.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, you mentioned JavaScript, and I hate JavaScript. when I was a web developer, so it was before JavaScript frameworks became so common in websites, just did a bit of JavaScript for little embellishments on websites like animations and things like that. But I think just distinguishing between the code is enough. And I do think HTML, CSS and JavaScript, they are distinguishable enough that you can look at the code of a website if you know a little bit about each of them and be able to tell the difference between the two of them. And so dev tools on browsers like Chrome dev tools, if you press F12 or it's accessible from the hamburger menu on Chrome, you can go in there and debug and see if there are JavaScript errors. And sometimes JavaScript errors might be related to a technical issue. Mm-hmm. So you don't necessarily need to know what the code is doing, but if you can look into Chrome Dev Tools or whatever browser you're using to audit websites and see, oh, this JavaScript is showing an error. I mean, it's not necessarily related to any SEO issue on the website, but sometimes if there's a particular issue and you sort of know enough, you could say to the web developer, you know, could it be this? So yeah, it can be a good little starting point. So just that little bit of knowledge.
Yeah, I think that little bit of knowledge, that's kind of where I am with a lot of stuff, of just being able to understand the basics of the structure and the kind of terminology that's used and all that kind of stuff, being able to identify, okay, I can tell this is JavaScript by looking at it, and I know that my colleague or my peer or whoever it is much better with JavaScript than I am. Hey, could you come and have a look at this? Does this make sense? Is this what's causing the error? All that kind of stuff. And I think that's the power of again, working in an agency. I think that's the benefit. Why I've enjoyed working in agencies for the majority of my career is having other people to bounce off ideas. And why I think the SEO community can be so great when we're not fighting on Twitter about alligators and Verge articles and whatever else. When it can be really supportive and really open and really communicative and being like, hey, I found this thing. Do you think it's this thing? And I think in general, again, very big generalization, but I think a lot of people are open to helping you out and answering questions, saying, oh, yeah, actually, yeah, this is a problem in your CSS, not in your JavaScript. This is why this is happening. I had a quick look, like you said, using DevTools or using whatever it is, like, and this is actually causing that problem. Having just enough knowledge to kind of be aware, to identify stuff, I think is kind of the sweet spot for a lot of people who kind of want to understand a little bit of the technical stuff, but not necessarily, like you said, go out and learn to code from scratch and go on one of the many, many free coding academy tools and all that kind of stuff you can do.
Yep.
So let's kind of wrap things up. We've got a last few bits here. Responsive web design, I think, is something very interesting for us to talk about. And again, something that I think perhaps more than anything else, because of the sheer amount of browsing that happens on phones now, it's one of those you don't notice it's there until it's bad. And it's something you really take for granted until you can't read the text or the text is suddenly going off the side of the screen or whatever. Enough, hopefully, thankfully, from my experience, enough websites are kind of building towards a lot of that stuff where you don't really think about it. But I don't know about you, Alex, but I think the case for most of us in SEO using our tools and actually looking at websites and stuff, you spend most of your time on desktop, right? So how do you think we could kind of balance that and understand where mobile first and responsive web design is important and how we're looking at it often from our desktop-based tools and stuff like that?
Yeah, like say, I mean, when I was a web developer, we actually had separate mobile and desktop websites. So there's an M.dot design to fit on the smaller screens of mobiles. Yeah, now responsive. I think most websites I use are responsive. So they'll just fit whatever device or screen you're browsing on. And yeah, we do most of our auditing on computers, don't we? So as you say, Google is mobile first. I think it's especially important to look at websites on mobile phones. So at Salience, I do recommend when anyone's auditing a website that they use their own mobile phone if they're happy to. and also go into Chrome or Safari Incognito, whatever browser they're using, and just make sure they're logged out of all sort of, I don't know, if they might have had Facebook open or TikTok and that kind of thing, because otherwise they'll get retargeting adverts of our clients and in their social feeds and that kind of thing. So yeah, use a mobile phone to check websites. It is really interesting to do because websites can be a lot less usable. And things like mega menus, so the main navigation on websites, they can get quite big, which on desktop devices is fine. You know, they're a lot easier to browse, but on mobile devices, it can become quite unwieldy. So any recommendations you make, you sort of have to be considering. I mean, most traffic these days, it's gone well over 50% is from mobile to the majority of websites I work on anyway. If you don't have a mobile phone to use, you can, again, go in Chrome Dev Tools, press F12, and there's a mobile emulator in there, so you can pick a range of different devices. You can put in your own. Another thing which is quite interesting, I think you can do in Chrome Tools and quite useful, when we work at an SEO agency or whether we're freelance or whatever, we likely have a pretty fast internet connection. Mm. And that might not represent what sort of a certain proportion of the website's audience and users have. And you can throttle the internet speed in Chrome Dev Tools. You can also simulate a lower powered device, which I think is really useful. So I actually went on, I won't name them, but I went on one of our clients' websites in my local library once, and it just crashed the browser. I just couldn't, it was pretty much unusable, the website was. So if you can just sort of simulate lower powered devices, then you can get an idea of the worst experience that people are having on your website or your client's website. And the problem with a lot of these sort of particular people that are having these experiences on your website, they might not show in data, they might not show in Google's Core Web Vitals, they might not show in analytics, because the experience might be that bad that the analytics tracking or whatever isn't triggering. So it's not actually being tracked how bad their experience is. So you can get an idea by looking at Core Web Vitals at the percentage of users that are having a sort of poor experience. It is only, I mean, I'm going off on a few tangents here, but it is only Chrome users that Core Web Vitals tracks.
Yep.
So it's sort of, although Chrome is the most popular browser, it's still a sort of limited demographic that that Google's showing you in Core Web Vitals. It's just one of those little things to be aware of. No data. I don't trust any data completely. I always try and go for multiple data sources. So I've gone off a bit of a tangent there, and I can't even remember what the original question was.
No, I think that is a really nice other kind of big takeaway, right, is don't just trust one data source. When you're looking at Core Web Vitals versus your Lighthouse versus whatever your experience as a browser versus, like you said, when you're replicating a thing with a lower power device or a 3G or a 4G connection or whatever it is, like, understanding how that website is experienced in multitude of different ways is a really important way of understanding how that website works, rather than just like, well, it's fine on my, like you said, gigabit fast, like, business line thing that you're working on in the office or whatever it is, or like, yeah, great, cool, but where are your users based? Do you have international users that are on in places that are, you know, typically lower speed internet connections, typically more people are using mobiles and all this kind of stuff? Like, I find a lot of that discussion happens around, oh yeah, most of our users use mobiles, or most of it, like you said, more than 50% in most cases now browsing from a mobile device. But how does that actually translate to their experience in terms of the internet connection, the tracking, all this kind of stuff that you don't really think about until you literally, and I totally do this, and I have done this on calls with clients and literally gone like, so here's my phone, here's what your website looks like on my phone. And for those not watching on YouTube, I'm literally holding up my phone. Like, I will do this to a client and be like, see, this is what this looks like. And the menu fundamentally doesn't work. The burger menu, as you said, Alex, like, if you get a mega menu that works really nicely and you've got this big widescreen monitor and it's all lovely, and then you get a burger menu that splays down and is 115 things long because all of your cascading subcategories suddenly don't cascade and it's just one massive list of stuff, that makes that menu unusable on mobile. And that is a direct anecdote from experience of mine with a client's website. Like, that is not me just pulling a number out. There were nearly 100 things on a mega menu because each subcategory would cascade into another subcategory. On mobile, auto expanded all of them at once, that is unusable. And you only know that if you pull your phone out and go, actually, yeah, let me have a look, let me check this thing. Because, yeah, you can simulate it all you want, but I think actually using it, even like switching, like you said, switching your Wi-Fi off and trying it on a 4G connection or something like that, like, how does that load when I'm outside in the middle of nowhere or whatever? Like, are most of our users based in big cities? Are our users based in these kind of areas? Like, understanding that and coming back round to that being a huge part of usability, I think is something a lot of us take for granted, for sure.
Definitely. I mean, got personal experience myself. I mean, it's quite a funny one because although I work in technology, I kind of hate technology. I'm not a big fan. And I still carry cash around with me all the time. And times I've been able to skip queues because the card payment hasn't been able to connect by the 4G or whatever. So I've sort of been sort of one of them was a Sea Power gig actually, sort of quite recently, and there's sort of quite a queue, and it was just taking for ages. People trying to buy T-shirts and things. I was just sort of peeking around, like seeing what's happening, and felt a bit rude, but like. Went to the front and said, oh, if it's a problem with the card payment, I've got cash. So I just paid and left a load of other people in the queue. So it's nice. It's sort of, it is related to web because, I mean, especially when there are sort of big crowds of people gathered together, 4G just goes really, really slow. So if people are using your website in those situations, it's going to be a lot slower than what you're sort of experiencing when you're generally auditing websites. And there might be people, your customer base might only use the computer in a local library or something like that. So, definitely, it's definitely important to not only test on mobile, but also I think simulate a sort of slower connection as well and slower powered devices, which, I mean, people do tend to simulate slower connections, but I think the slower powered devices is something that people don't tend to do. And I think it's a bit of a hidden gem in Chrome dev tools.
Yeah, that's something I think a lot of people, like you said, the lower power devices, I can't remember, there was a statistic that was like, it was like the average power of a typical mobile in like different parts of the world. Like if in the UK, the average is like 4 or 5 generations behind the typical Apple or Samsung or Android like flagship devices, if you're rocking the mega ultra pro 25 or whatever it is, actually most people are probably on the 17, 18, 19 versions because not everyone updates their mobile every single time. I don't know, I helped my dad over Christmas install an Android device for the first time and like understand how apps work and stuff. He'd never used a smartphone before, and it was a Samsung, don't get me wrong, but it was like the A something something brand or whatever. It was not the S23 Ultra with the Snapdragon 8 processor and all this kind of stuff. My dad was like, does it play music? Can I read stuff on it? It's like, yes. Can you read the football results? Yes, you can, Dad. That's fine. Like, most people don't need super duper high powered mega gaming processing kind of things. And most people don't have that because they are really bloody expensive. And I think there was that kind of like a lot of people misunderstand or underestimate how many people actually use lower power devices and things that are not the super top end, because it is such a big part of our culture to be like, you've got to have the latest iPhone, you've got to have the latest Samsung, you've got to be, especially us working in tech, right? You've got to have the latest tech as part of your stack. It's like, yeah, but the real actual people out there probably aren't doing that.
But I've got a £100 Motorola, so I'm a bit of an exception in the tech world. But also, sometimes people using really powerful devices, they might be doing something else. You know, they might be they might be video editing or something in the background, and so their device's processing power is being used on the video editing. So even though they're using a powerful computer or something, they could still experience a slow website if it's a complex website. The way it's sort of coded, and perhaps if it's rendered client side rather than server side. So even people with powerful devices, depending on what else they're doing with their device at that time, they can still have a slow experience as well. So I think that's something else that's worth noting.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. So let's wrap things up, I think, with what Mark considers the golden rule of SEO. And I agree, and I think you'll agree as well, Alex, is don't make SEO changes that make usability worse. That is the golden, if we could have it just like tattooed across the top of the screen here, like that is the golden rule for SEO. And I'm so glad you kind of put this in the show notes, because that is something I feel like I've hammered home to basically every client I've ever spoken to over the last few years.
I completely agree. I mean, sometimes it's again a bit of a tangent kind of, but we've had clients who think SEO recommendations we're making are sort of making the usability worse. And so I sort of have to sort of say to them, well, can you show me why you think it's making the usability worse, or discuss this? So I don't know if it's still sometimes just that expectation that SEO is against usability and, you know, maybe just makes web developers' life harder. But yeah, generally, 100%, if an SEO change is going to make usability worse, then don't do it. And there are a lot of good SEO is basically good usability as well. There is a lot of crossover. there are things that are specifically for technical SEO. But yeah, generally, I think if you make a website that's user-friendly, then you are going some way towards a website that's also SEO-friendly.
Yep, 100% agreed. I think that is kind of the thing that I think a lot of people underestimate. Again, I know I'm using underestimate a lot here and take for granted, is that whole 100% of the time. I can't think of an example where you would benefit from making the user experience worse by implementing an SEO thing and have it be a benefit for that site at the end of the day. Because as we kicked off this episode saying, it is humans that are using your website. It is users. They are potential customers, potential clients, however you want to look at them. It is the people that are using your website at the end of the day. And the fact that user experience and SEO should intrinsically be understood and linked together when you're thinking about your website is something a lot of people, like I said, I think we're moving in the right direction. A lot of the industry is coming around to that idea and thinking about that, but I think it is a golden rule that we should really all be sticking to by now in 2024.
Yeah, and definitely Google especially is moving towards that as best as it can. You know, I think I said earlier, didn't I, about whatever machines can judge as good usability, Google are trying to do and implement into their search algorithms.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you so much for joining me, Alex. I think it's been a really interesting chat about all things technical SEO that we've kind of been taken for granted and underestimated and stuff like that. I mentioned I follow you on Twitter and LinkedIn and all that kind of stuff. Where can the listeners and viewers follow up with you if they want to keep up with your SEO knowledge and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so Twitter is Alex Harford SEO. There's no T in Harford. It does get misspelt a bit. I don't really use Twitter that much, but yeah, I'm there. I mean, Elon Musk started making it worse just after I finally decided to join as an SEO. So yeah, I'm on LinkedIn as Alex Harford UK. I mean, if you Google Alex Harford SEO, I'll pop up somewhere. Thanks for the opportunity to speak. I really enjoyed it.
So it's great to be on
something I enjoy listening to as well.
So. I appreciate it. I really enjoy having the conversation with you. I really like having kind of a bit of a nerd out, you know. And I know we said this before we start recording, we could be talking about video games and RPGs all day long, but it's nice to have a little bit of an SEO nerd out now and then as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Alex.
Cheers, Jack.
And that about wraps up episode 6 of season 3. Thank you so much for watching or listening, wherever you are watching or listening. I will be back next week with plenty of awesome, cool stuff. We have loads of fantastic guests coming up. I recently recorded an episode with Hannah Butcher that I'm really looking forward to. Also recorded with Nate Matheson from Positional as well. Both completely different but equally interesting conversations. And of course, we will have me and Mark back here in the studio talking all about the latest news and updates you need to know about the SEO world. Beginning of March, that'll essentially be the first episode of March, we'll recap all of February, essentially. So stay tuned for that in a few weeks as well. Of course, we're getting bigger and better. We're doing more and more video stuff. So keep an eye out for us on your YouTube Shorts. We're doing a little TikTok stuff as well. So if you're not already following us, links for all that stuff will be in the show notes. Of course, links for everything Alex and I talked about on this episode will be in the show notes as well. So if you don't want links to a few of those articles Alex mentioned towards the end there, they are in the show notes. You can go and check them out. You can also go to search.withcandor.co.uk. There's the links for basically everything. If you want to go and watch the show and you're listening to the show, if you want to listen to the show and you've been watching the show, get all the different links, get all the different stuff. You can go to our website and find the blog post about this specific episode. Like I said, thank you so much for listening. If this is your first episode, welcome. I still find people finding the podcast even now, you know, 250 episodes later. But yeah, if you've been here since day one, a huge thank you as well. I know a lot of people joined when I joined the podcast or kind of joined along the way, but a lot of you have been day one since Mark was hosting way back in 2019. So thank you so much for your support over the years. And yeah, until next week, have a lovely week.